What is your major malfunction, numbnut? Didn't mommy and daddy show you enough attention when you were a child?
And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone.
Who's your daddy? Who's your dad? Oh, slow down.
Real messages arrive, and other people have remembered, and they come back to us and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just for them.
The truth shall set you free, but first, it will piss you off. Naughty by Nature with Nature Boy. Interesting people with interesting ideas for an interesting conversation. Welcome to the show, everybody. We have a very special guest for us tonight, a man that I've known for a long time, and I feel honored to call him friend. He is one of the best researchers since Dave McGowan, and I mean that seriously. He has sent me links and things over the years that have blown my mind. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to start off the conversation with one that really hit home with me. He is a researcher. He is a podcaster. He is a brilliant man and one of the nicest, most down-to-earth people you could ever hope to meet. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show the fantastic Chris Graves. How are you, amigo?
I am a lot better now, Mr. Naughty by Nature, Mr. Nature Boy. And thank you for having me on the show, and I hope to not let you down.
You never do, Chris. You never do. I mean, over the years, I've respected you so much because you're an encyclopedia, a walking encyclopedia of knowledge. I mean, you know, so many times you've thrown things at me and says, hey, did you know about this? Did you know about that? And there are things I didn't realize or know. And everything that you have since checked out, has checked out. So I really want to get this conversation started. And I like to hit the third rail of topics right off the bat to see how long it takes me to get canceled. My first Twitter page for the show lasted less than 30 days before it got canceled. So
really,
yeah, man. And it was
so Elon King gunning for you, huh?
Something. It was a weird cancellation. It says we're canceling you for you're being suspended for evading the suspension rules. And I'm like, what? Funny. I've never been suspended, but you're suspending me for evading suspension rules. For
free speech, basically, right?
I don't know what happened, but the way I equate it is you're convicting me for a jail sentence for escaping jail,
right?
But I've never been arrested. I mean,
right.
It's social media, it's AI algorithms. In this day and age, it's really hard to know what's going on or the truth, which is...
Isn't that something funny that... I don't mean to cut you off.
No, like, please.
These creators or these owners, if you will, they can just hide behind, oh, it's just the AI bots. It's the algorithm that's censoring you, not me.
Yeah.
And he was all champion. He was all about like, oh, I'm Mr. Free Speech. I'm going on Joe Rogan. And you know what? You can say whatever you want unless he doesn't like it.
Exactly.
And then you get your ass tossed. Right.
Freedom of speech, not freedom of reach, was his statement. To me, Elon is a Judas goat in many respects, if you will. That's kind of how I see him. I mean, there's so much of me that I really like his rhetoric. Free speech, we're about this, we're about that. But I've learned a long...
That's because that was the talking points given to him by many other people over the years. I can't prove it, but I got a gut. I got a big fat gut, right? I'm a big fat guy.
Right.
I have a gut instinct that people like him and, you know, Alex Jones, certain people that have prominence like in media nowadays, even who's the guy, Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I actually have disagreements with a good friend of mine named John Jeffries about Tucker Carlson. I think Tucker, I mean, Tucker, didn't Tucker brag about how his family has like CIA ties or whatever? I know Alex Jones said, oh yeah, I got CIA in the family and everything. He like brags about it.
Right.
But then he goes and rails against the CIA, like in the next breath, you know. And I know it's like everyone says everyone's a shill, but there really are things like there really are shills out there.
I think that
and I think Elon is basically, you know, given his talking points like Bill Gates was before him and Zuckerberg. Even. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Even with the whole Facebook narrative. That was a different program, like at a certain time before Facebook went online, and I cut you off, so I apologize.
No, that you're talking about LifeLog, and I find it ironic that it was it the same day LifeLog went offline that Facebook came online. It's almost like a cutover.
Exactly.
And when you look at a lot of these Intel companies, or these, not Intel companies, but I'll come back to that. Yeah. They're basically these high-tech companies. When you follow the money and you know, being the researcher you are, you want to find out what's going on behind the scenes, you follow the money and it'll tell you everything. It all seems to come back to InQtel. And for the listeners out there,
you know about that. InQtel was the CIA's basically pocketbook.
Right.
When it came to investing in these different, well, you could say it better than me.
It was their, what was it?
Research capital. And division, like,
it was basically
research and development division, I think, where they could unlimited funds, where you didn't know where the funds came from.
It was capital investment. So it was a capital investment firm that was literally, and it is, and they make no bones about it. It's run by the CIA. It's kind of
Q is right in the title. Q.
Yeah, in QTEL.
I always laughed about that. InQtel, I think, right?
Well, trust the plan. Elon's good. He's a white hat. He's behind the scenes working diligently.
He's going to save us all, everybody.
So is Orange Jesus.
Is Orange Jesus. That's my good friend, Harlan Stonewall.
I love that. I love that. That guy's just, he's a character. So, yeah, I mean, when you have to really look at everything objectively these days. And it doesn't mean that one has to make a determination, but you really have to look at all aspects. And we'll get back to, let's just bring in Tucker Carlson again. I know that he admitted to applying for the CIA, but I also heard a rumor, which I don't know if it's true, that he actually interned with the CIA, just like Anderson Cooper, or I like to call him Anderson Pooper, Mr. Vanderbilt.
Anderson Vanderbilt?
Yeah, Anderson Vanderbilt. He interned for, I believe, 2 summers with the CIA. And knowing what you know about Operation Mockingbird, the new name, they never disappear. They just change the name to protect the guilty and continue on and get better. That
like
you
anything
have,
else, hmm? Any other, like anything else in history, it didn't stop.
No.
It evolved, right?
Right.
And when it comes to this new alt to the alt, like I have friends that they like to, you know, use the alt to the alt. Any person with a position of prominence in any kind of media that has influence over the public opinion.
Right.
That was infiltrated way back in the day. And it's just evolved, man. Like it really has. Mockingbird. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld had a program in 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks, called Total Awareness. And basically, well, it wasn't just that, but there was a Department of War Propaganda where he was given money to open up an office in the Pentagon where it would basically put out false information, disinfo about basically what became weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. And in January or February of 2002, he was forced to close up shop when it came to Total Awareness and the propaganda, basically like Soviet era style, like Pravda kind of propaganda. And he, under pressure, he was he had to close up shop in like January or February of 2002. And I don't think they stopped that propaganda, obviously.
No, they just changed the name to protect the guilty, and they continue on and continue to evolve.
Right.
And the level of propaganda that we are being subjected to, especially the youth, with all of these devices. I mean, these kids literally pop out of the womb, and parents just give them these screens so their mind is developing. And you and I are the age where that's not so significant, right? But when you think about children whose brains are now forming, and they're forming around this device, and the propaganda, which is would make Edward Bernays so proud.
Bernays.
That they're being subjected to this, and most people aren't even aware of the concept. They just absorb the content. And there's a reason why they've always called TV programs programming, because you can go back to the history of television, from the flicker rates to different scenes that they put behind you that put you into an alpha state, which is almost a hypnotic state that makes you susceptible. And I like to tell friends to really prove that point about the hypnotic effect of a television is, I say, have you ever walked into a room where there's a really good movie on the screen and looked at everybody's faces looking at that in that room? And that they're visual, they're like this, they're in a trance. And that's the power of media. And that's back from our days. And it was very powerful. Now think about how it's being evolved. The hardware end of it, the software end of it, where you have, and this is just an open practice with software companies, right? They hire addiction specialists, not as a precautionary thing, quite the opposite. They hire them to develop their product to be the most addictive possible, because that keeps people on the screen and it keeps engagement. And if the bigger the engagement, the more money that they can bring in from the advertisers. And it's a real weird time we're living in. I think it's when Orwell had Winston working in the Ministry of Truth, and his job was to stuff down literally the memory hole. And at that time, it was pages out of books because they didn't have this. We have evolved so far past it. 10 years ago, you could go out and even do a Google search, and you could find relative results. You know, you say, for instance, I'm watching a Bill Cooper video, and I want, and it brings up all sorts of other things. YouTube, let's get down to YouTube, all sorts of different relative results and videos. Now, I don't care what I'm watching, Chris. I don't care how deep and dirty the documentary is or the speech or the talk I'm listening to. I look over my recommended, and it's all music videos, producer videos, cruising videos, which I like. I really, when I'm bozing out, I like it, but the AI has gotten to the point where it knows me so well that it delivers what it thinks I want to see, as opposed to what I'm looking for. And it's just getting more. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I give you four examples of the memory hole that I've experienced myself? Yeah,
totally.
JFK Jr., right? His plane went down in July 16th, 1999. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Shepard Smith?
Yes,
he had a show on Fox.
I do remember Shepard Smith.
Shepard Smith. Saturday, January 17th, 1999, Shepard Smith was talking about a witness to an explosion in the sky off of Martha's Vineyard, which would have been JFK Jr.'s plane. He actually named the person that was in the wedding party of Rory Kennedy, who I've actually met, had a picture with 3 years ago. I am myself and a good friend of mine who I do research for his books, Mr. Donald Jeffries of Hidden History.
I do know.
We've been trying to find these explosion in the sky witnesses. There was a reporter for the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. Mm-hmm. Who went missing, probably dead now.
Probably dead.
He claimed he was walking on Philbin Beach, which is at the very end of Martha's Vineyard. Mm-hmm. We can't find him. Nobody can find him. But Steve Sprasia of WCBB Channel 5 in Boston, he interviewed the guy the day after the plane supposedly disappeared. Not supposedly, it did disappear. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find it for like a week.
Yeah.
Including the Coast Guard. And Bill Clinton sent out the Coast Guard and said, oh, yeah, this is top priority.
And well, you have
they
to
found
search.
The wreckage.
You have to search for wrong. You have to search in the right area to find the wreckage, or you're just going to find fish and water.
So you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Bill Cooper found the archive footage and news bites from WCVB Channel 5 in Boston. He's the reason why John Hankey was able to have in his documentary the assassination of JFK Jr. Mm-hmm. The footage from Susan Wojcicki and Steve Sprazia talking on air about how JFK Jr. had a radio contact with the tower at Martha's Vineyard Airport, mm-hmm. saying he was awaiting landing instructions. He was not like being a daredevil, right. how they claimed in the media, how he was a daredevil playboy, didn't give a shit about his wife and his sister-in-law and everything, and that he just spiraled into the Atlantic Ocean. He was waiting landing instructions from a guy named Buddy Wyatt. Mm-hmm. His nickname was Buddy.
Right.
It was Marvin Wyatt. And I contacted Marvin Wyatt during the pandemic. And it'll be in Hidden History 3 whenever Skyhorse decides to publish Donald Jeffrey's Hidden History 3. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with Buddy Wyatt. And he confirmed that, yeah, JFK Jr., that they took the tapes, the FAA took the tapes that would confirm that JFK Jr. was in contact with the tower and was awaiting landing instructions on the night of July 16th, 1999.
No.
And I'm telling you, Bill Cooper was able, Bill Cooper, with the hour of the time, a shortwave radio program that he had in the fall of 1999. He did two episodes in October, I believe, of 1999. And you can find it still online where he talks about how he had people on the ground at the archives for WCVB and Channel 5 in Boston. They were located in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. That's why the footage that is in John Hankey's film Dark Legacy 2, a.k.a. the assassination of JFK Jr. That's why that footage exists. It's because Bill Cooper had people on the ground that went and got the footage before WCVB and the archives in New Hampshire was able to get rid of it. Because they claimed afterwards that 6 hours of July 17th footage was gone. And that included all of the references to the explosion in the sky witnesses, including the guy that was supposed to be at Rory Kennedy's wedding that Shepard Smith had mentioned, Chet Curtis, who was an on-air personality. He went to his grave basically saying that, oh yeah, there was no conspiracy going on, even though Donald Jeffries went and contacted him again years later. Steve Sprazia was also the guy. He was the guy that talked to the old man reporter from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette that confirmed that he saw an explosion in the sky on the night of July 16th, 1999. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, Steve Sprazia changed his story because I got him in contact with Donald Jeffries. Don didn't have the time to interview him at the time. So I went and contacted another guy who is not very popular these days by the name of Ed Opperman.
I know Ed. I like Ed. His sound sucks, but his content's killer.
Well, I told Ed all the things. I said, well, this guy saw an explosion in the sky, right? Mm-hmm. He barely mentioned it, but he did. To his credit, Ed, and he mentioned it at the end of the interview with Steve Sprazia that I had set up. Because Steve Sprazia also was a witness. I'm going all over the place. So
I'm interested. I love to hear you talk and to go off because I learned so much, man. I've never heard of. I mean,
Steve Sprazia was a witness to a diamond shaped UFO over the Rainham racetrack that's within the Bridgewater Triangle where I actually reside to this day.
Right.
It's kind of like a Bermuda Triangle, but on land, where a lot of weird shit has occurred. Mm-hmm. Steve Frazier was a local reporter even back then, but he also was the guy that went to Martha's Vineyard that morning that JFK Jr.'s plane had gone missing. And he talked to this guy who had sent, he described him as an older gentleman who didn't want to give his name, but he was a reporter for the local newspaper, the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. And here's the weird thing, Nature Boy. Can I call you Nature Boy? Like, yeah, I don't know what to call you right now. I know your real name, but anyway, there's another guy, another author by the name of John Conner, who wrote a book that was kind of similar to my friend Donald Jeffrey's Hidden History 3 with the JFK Jr. assassination. Because at this point, I'm convinced that he was killed because he would have became president if, had he been able to run. Yeah. Because you also have the George W. Bush was running for president at the time. But you also had the Hillary Clinton thing, too. Yeah. So you got the Bushes and the Clintons kind of going against JFK Jr. at the time. Hillary Clinton wanted to become the senator of New York in the fall of 1999. JFK Jr. actually was raised in New York after his father's assassination. Jackie they brought him to New York City, and he was kind of a staple in the community in New York. JFK Jr. was in contact with Al Gore's people in terms of campaigning and things. Mm-hmm. So he was ready to run for either the seat, the Senate seat in New York in 1999. Do you know a guy, a researcher by the name of Barry, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Shamus? Barry Shamus.
He basically would go against Israel in terms of the Israeli Mossad, things like that. The assassination of Rabin, which John F. Kennedy Jr. ran a piece by Oliver Stone, of all people, about the assassination I feel so stupid right now because I went to public school right now. Barry Chamish, Chamish, who I tried to contact. I know Donald contacted him for him.
I don't know if he's still alive. I think he's died, hasn't he?
Has he passed on? Because he had a lot of explosive information in terms of 9/11, even when it comes to the Mossad. But that's a different thing altogether. JFK Jr. had a personal limo driver that would drive him from the airplane hangar in New Jersey, where he would keep his airplane, right? Mm-hmm. And Barry Chamish, or however you pronounce his name, I feel really stupid right now. I think it's Chamish.
It's good enough, I think. I think we get the thing. Oh, by the way, I just looked it up. He died August 23rd, 2016 at 64 years of age.
All right. Donald was one of the last people to actually be in contact with him, I believe. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that means, all right, so that, I guess that's the reason why he never got back to me.
Probably because he's dead.
Okay. Anyway, he had claimed that he was witness to seeing George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush outside of JFK Jr.'s hangar in that New Jersey airport that is escaping me at the moment because it's been a while. But
right.
And some people like to point to that as circumstantial evidence that maybe W was a part of a blood sacrifice, because there's a lot of people that think that George H.W. Bush was actually in Dealey Plaza and was a spotter in the Daltex building.
Well, he did say, when questioned, he said, well, where were you on that day? I don't remember. I'm like, George W. Bush, right? Say what you will about as evil as that son of a bitch is, but he was brilliant. He was a brilliant, evil man, and you don't know where you were the day Kennedy was assassinated when everybody in the nation can recall exactly
where they were.
Right, exactly. So that makes me a little suspicious. Go on, I didn't mean to interject.
Well, no. Well, what you were saying was George H.W. Bush, right? The president from 1988 to 1992, mm-hmm. before Bill Clinton, another conspiratorial presidential candidate with a background in the CIA.
And cocaine trafficking, by the way. His brother was literally convicted. Yeah, but that's another show.
Anybody out there that is interested, if you look into the Boys on the Tracks murders, mm-hmm. there's these two boys, and their names escape me at the moment because I'm getting very old right now and my health is going downhill. But Donald Jeffries, in his book, Hidden History, wrote about the Boys on the Tracks. And that was two teenage boys that most likely saw things that they weren't supposed to. Yeah. Illegal drug drops outside of the Mena, Arkansas airport.
Yes.
And there's even a wrestler that's attached to all that named Billy Jack. Billy Jack Hayes, I think he was his last name. I don't want to give up someone else's name. But have you heard of this guy named Billy Jack Hayes?
No, I haven't. I've studied Mena, Arkansas quite a bit, but not to the level you have. Who is Billy Jack?
Billy Jack Haynes. I think Haynes is his last name. He was a wrestler, kind of an amateurish wrestler at the time, mm-hmm. that moonlighted as kind of an enforcer when it comes to drug trafficking and drug deals and things like that. He claimed that he videotaped in 1987 the Boys on the Tracks, their murders.
Really?
With an old-fashioned VHS tape that he videotaped, where the cops in Arkansas, Mena, Arkansas, they set up the boys' bodies on the tracks, the railroad tracks, with a blue tarp, set them up so that they could claim later on that the boys got high in the woods. And got ran over by a train.
Yeah, they got high and they decided, hey, dude, it's like, it's just like, what's a good idea, man? There's a pillow. We can use the train tracks as like a pillow, bro. Let's just like get high and crash out, bro.
I hate to laugh, but that's basically what Billy, you know, and that's what the official story became. Mm-hmm. Was that these two boys smoked too much marijuana and they fell asleep on the railroad tracks and got ran over.
Yeah, I smoked a lot of weed back in my day, right? And I never got so high that I'm like, dude, I'm just going to pass out. And then to pass out on a railroad track, come on, man.
Well, here's the thing. The parents of the boys demanded a second autopsy.
Yes, they did.
And then it was found that they had knife stabbings, and they were beaten before
skull fractures
placed on the railroad tracks. And I think it was about maybe, don't quote me, but I think it was like a couple of dozen witnesses supposedly existed that they got killed too.
Yeah,
to the boys' murder.
I remember one of them. That the coroner, who was as corrupt as a day is long.
And he was attached to Mr. Bill Clinton.
Right, exactly. What was it? This kid got shot with a shotgun blast or something like that. Can't happen through suicide.
One kid even decapitated himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he was so distraught about what he saw. He cut his own head off in a dumpster.
And it's a suicide. Nothing to see here. Kind of like, you know, Mr. Cobain, it's a suicide. Nothing to see here. Move along.
You know about
move
along. Oh, yeah, Mr. Cobain. Well, yeah, that was something I looked into quite a bit.
I met Hank Harrison, and I booked him for Chuck's show, and turns out that he lives a couple towns over from me. So we'd talk periodically, and we were trying to get together. And unfortunately, schedules didn't match, and he passed away before we could go. But he wrote the book Love Kills. He has the same overall thesis that Tom Grant did in Soaked in Bleach.
I worked for Tom Grant before, about a decade before I was doing research for Mr. Donald Jeffries. I was doing research for Mr. Tom Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually in 2011. Mm-hmm. It was either 2011 or 2012. I confronted the guy who actually killed Kirk in Beverly Hills.
What was his name? Caleb or something like that?
Yeah, I'll just say that he may have been in the employ of a certain Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain.
Mm-hmm. He was their nanny, I believe, if you were thinking about the same person.
I believe you're right.
And he's the one that supposedly wrote the note that was left on the stairs for Kurt or something.
Confound.
Yeah.
Confound. That it was basically, how dare you be in here without me knowing? It was all right. This whole bunch of crap that was in the film. Kurt and Courtney by Nick Broomfield, and I think they brought it back up in a film called Soaked in Bleach that came out in 2014 by a guy that I was supposed to have on my show eventually. I'm trying to remember that gentleman's name, but the filmmaker of Soaked in Bleach, he was actually impressed by the interview I did with Chuck Ocelli I don't think you can find it anymore, but it was about a year ago. And I had gone on a few shows. I even talked about it on Tinfoil Hat with Sam Tripoli. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was a guy that was hired by Courtney, who was her ex boyfriend, you could say, or they basically shared drugs, but he was hired to take care of a young Francis Bean. And he was the only one on the property. Mm-hmm. Besides, there's a woman named Jessica Hopper. Have you ever heard of her?
Yes, the name's familiar. I think she was in Tom Grant's book.
Well, not only that, but she ended up getting a cushy job at Geffen Records as like an A&R rep. But she ended up writing a couple of books later on, and she did a Q&A session with the general public. I believe it was like either 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever. Someone questioned her about, well, where were you when Kurt's body was found? And she got all distraught, and she was hemming and hawing and everything. And she couldn't basically deny the fact that she was on the property when Kurt's body was found. And she admitted that she was puking on the side of the driveway at the Lake Washington property. Mm-hmm. Well, what did she see that day that would get her so distraught that she'd be puking on the side of the driveway while being whisked away off the property? His body in the greenhouse?
Maybe. I know if I saw his body with the head partially blown off, it would make me a little bit queasy.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Nature Boy.
What's that?
His head wasn't blown off.
Well, it was partially, wasn't
Barney
it?
And No, it was...
So where did...
Shotgun was placed into his mouth, and it only went into... what do you call it? With the roof of the mouth, your soft pellet, or whatever.
It was a small caliber shotgun, too. It wasn't a 12-gauge. I think it was something like a 20-gauge.
I think it was 27.
A 20 gauge, which, I mean,
it was for home protection, right?
Right, yeah.
It had two other shells in the chamber. So did he load it up with three, hoping that he wouldn't miss?
Ask Gary Webb. Oh, you can't. He died with two shots to the head.
With Kurt. Courtney embellished on that. I'm glad you went into this because I know this even more than the other stuff we were talking about.
Yeah, cool. I like this.
Here's the thing. Kurt's heart had stopped beating at that point. That's why you didn't have a gory mess like Courtney had described for her child to read years later.
Yeah.
His head wasn't blown off at all. He had a little pool of blood coming out of his ear on the side of his head. His head was intact. Wow. But she described it like there was brain matter everywhere. Yeah. Didn't care. She described to his fans, who I will say this, Tom Grant has gone on record saying that he got letters from Kurt Cobain fans years later saying, you know, thank you for describing all the homicide information that you were able to put together, because I would have blew my head off like my hero Kurt Cobain.
Well, there were a lot of copycat suicides.
Over 100 worldwide.
100? Wow.
Tom Tom Grant on the Alan. Do you remember Alan Handelman?
No, not familiar with him.
He had a rock, kind of like a rock talk show on the internet, on the radio in the, you know, the mid 2000s or whatever. He did a couple of shows with Tom Grant, and he had Tom Grant back on, like, in 2014, I believe. It was like the 20th anniversary. It was one of those anniversary things. Tom Grant started bawling his eyes out, saying that there were a lot of teenagers at the time that wrote to him and said, thank you for putting out the information you had, because I would have killed myself like my hero. And because you were able to put out this information that pointed to the contrary, that he may have been murdered, I didn't kill myself.
Nice.
And just hearing Tom talk about that.
Hey, Chris.
Because people go, oh, yeah, Tom is making all this money. He went bankrupt a few times trying to keep the Cobain case alive.
Authors don't, unless there's a few authors that get rich, but most of them don't. It's like rock stars. You get a few of them that get rich, but most musicians, they die broke. Hey, Chris, let's take a little break right here, if you don't mind. But I definitely want to hold. I want you to hold that thought, because I think this was a better conversation than what I originally wanted the show to be.
That's
why
I went off on the JFK Jr. thing.
That's why I wanted you on your Wealth of Cornucopia. And the whole thing about my show is interesting people with interesting ideas. And the most important thing is an interesting conversation. And what I found with conversations that are good conversations, they take a life on its own. So everybody out there, I'm going to take a really quick break and we'll be right back. All right. We're back from that quick break. How quick was that? Oh, about a millisecond or two, but we had some business we had to take care of and we got it done. And now we're back. When we left, by the way, everybody, I'm so blessed and so privileged to have the great Chris Graves here, researcher extraordinaire. I honestly had a topic that I wanted to discuss over the show, but he brought up JFK and these, and they're actually much better topics than what I wanted to discuss. But we could go into that in another show another day. Where we left off from the break was Chris was describing to us when he actually met Callie, the person suspected of killing Kurt Cobain. Now, he's a suspect because there's no evidentiary proof. So please don't sue me. It's the alleged murderer of Kurt Cobain. Go ahead, Chris. What will you continue on, please?
Well, he was the only one on the property besides Jessica Hopper, his girlfriend, who went on to work for Geffen Records. She had a
cushy job, probably.
A cushy job of what is the correct term? A&R or
like, artist relations. A&R. They're the liaison between the band and the suits.
It basically in control of trying to find new talent for Geffen Records at the time. And she ended up writing for various periodicals, magazines, whatever that had to do with, the Riot Girl movement at the time, those kind of bands, the punk rock bands at the time. And she was confronted at a Q&A a few years ago about her whereabouts when Kurt's body was found. And it came up that she was kind of whisked away by Callie, her boyfriend at the time, Mr. Callie DeWitt, who was Frances Bean Cobain's nanny at the time. And his best friend, who his name is escaping me right now, but his best friend's girlfriend was Macaulay Culkin's older half-sister, who ended up dying mysteriously in 1999. Not mysteriously, because some people say she just had an overdose, but she was working at a home for people with, addiction issues and things like that. I think her last name was A-R-A-M Aramison.
So this was Callie's girlfriend at the time?
Well, no, Callie's girlfriend was a woman named Jessica Hopper.
Okay, so who was friends with Macaulay Culkin's
Callie's best friend.
Right.
I wish I had it in front of me, and I apologize for
no apologies.
My research right now, but Callie's best friend was also on the property, and his girlfriend was there too. And his girlfriend was Macaulay Culkin's half-sister, older half-sister, who ended up dying on the job in 1999 at a home for people with addiction issues and things like that.
Sounds like she took a few minutes, too few mini CCs, if you know what I mean.
Right. And that, you know, that very well could have been the case that she just died of natural, not natural, but you know what I mean, like substance abuse happenings or whatever, if you will. But she had to have been there and saw some things too, because it was the week that Kurt's body was found on April 8th, 1994. At the time, Courtney Love had hired private detective Tom Grant to look for Kurt because he supposedly went missing from the Exodus Rehab facility in Los Angeles at the time. It was claimed that Kurt hopped the wall and took off to the airport. But here's the thing. That was the type of facility where you could just walk out the front door and there wouldn't have been a problem.
Of course.
But Courtney in the media liked to say that he hopped the wall as if he was under lock and key and under constant, you know.
Well, she was a master manipulator. She was. And
he admitted this on Tom Grant's audio recordings that he was recording because he's a private investigator. So he has, I think.
That's what Hank Harrison told me. And it's also in his book, that she was Mensa-level intelligence, and she was a master manipulator. My personal take is she was a minimum of a sociopath, if not a psychopath. And you put all of those ingredients together, and you got one strong, powerful, evil person. Evil. And that's kind of how I see Courtney. If she was to ever say, "Hi, I'm Courtney Love," I'd be like, "Well, I'm Bill Williams, and my mama's calling me. Bye-bye."
Well, I'll tell you, anyone wants to look at Courtney Love and her background, just type in El Duce in 1997 and see his demise, his ending with a train in Riverside, California. He had connections. He passed a polygraph of the guy that gave O.J. Simpson the polygraph, where O.J. failed that polygraph. But El Duce, a guy named his real name was Eldon Hoke.
I think I know what you're talking about, but go on.
His stage name was El Duce, and he was the lead singer and songwriter for the horrible, horrible rape rock, in their own words, rape rock band, The Mentors.
Art. And go figure.
He ended up getting creamed by a train after going on camera with Nick Broomfield, the filmmaker that made the documentary Kurt and Courtney in 1998. He went on camera and said that he was offered $50,000 by Courtney Love to kill her fucking old man.
Yeah.
And here's the map and here's what to do and everything. But then he claimed that he didn't do it, but he knows the guy that did. It was his good friend. Guy by the, I don't really want to mention his name because he's already made so much off of it, but I'll just say it because people will see it online anyway.
That's public knowledge.
He claimed his good friend Alan Rich, who was also a punk rocker at the time, was the one that Courtney paid to kill Kurt. And this Alan Rich character came forward and, you know, basically was questioned about it and said, "Oh, I didn't do anything," you know, and he kind of made his bones off of, you know, killing Kurt without actually killing Kurt. Because he wasn't in the Lake Washington property at the time. He didn't have the means. He really, I mean, there were claims in Ian Halperin, you ever heard of him? And Max Wallace, they wrote the books Kill Kurt Cobain and Love and Death, The Murder of Kurt Cobain.
Familiar, yeah. But I don't
know. He wrote those books with cooperation from Tom Grant, but Tom Grant's not convinced that this Alan Rich character was actually Kurt's killer, just because he wouldn't have been privy to a lot of things, including the fact that a Callie DeWitt was actually in the house when Kirk came back from the Seattle airport on April 2nd. Mm-hmm. There was a Melody Maker magazine article in 1994 that claimed that Kurt filed a police report fearing for his life. You can't find that article to this day.
Yeah.
Or the police report. And here's the possibility. There was a cop, there was a police officer that Courtney was very close with, and his name was Detective Antonio Terry.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first Seattle cops to be killed on the job in like 20 years, where he was basically taken out execution style. Wow. In June of 1994 on the off ramp of the highway.
Wow.
He was in Kurt's missing persons report, which was filed illegally by Courtney, as she was claiming to be Kurt's mother, Wendy O'Connor, mm-hmm. which is an illegal act. Mm-hmm. She was pretending to be Kurt's mother, and that she was scared for Kurt's life. There was a line at the end of the missing persons report that said, see Detective Antonio Terry for further information in terms of the source of the narcotics that would later be found in Kurt's body in terms of the heroin. Mm-hmm. If you look, going back, if you look, Kurt's heart had to have been stopped. Mm-hmm. That's why there wasn't a gory mess. I tried to mention that earlier, but
right,
he only had a trickle of blood coming out of his ear.
Well, in terms of, may I interject here for a second to go what you're talking about here? One of the things that was in Tom Grant's book was that he had, when they did a toxicology on his body, he had three times the lethal limit
lethal dose of heroin.
Now, you got to keep in mind, a regular user builds up a tolerance, but triple it. And then two, he actually had reduced or stopped using heroin.
In November of 1993, mm-hmm. he made the claim that he was free of it, because the reason he claimed that he was using heroin to begin with, which was introduced to him by Courtney Love when their relationship began,
mm-hmm.
was that he had a pinched nerve in his stomach and that he was in excruciating pain. But he had made the claim in November of 1993 that his doctor was able to diagnose it and give him proper medication, mm-hmm. and that he no longer needed the assistance of opiates and heroin. So he had been, supposedly, if you go by Kurt's word, clean. People be like, he was a junkie, why would we do that? If you go by Kurt's word, he wasn't dependent on heroin for pain anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that would make his tolerance even lower.
Exactly. It would make it like you or I, where an average hit for a hardcore junkie would put us into an overdose.
Now, just think about this, Major Boy.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to have that much heroin,
right,
would you just lay back and go to sleep peacefully?
Well, before,
or would you have an image for your daughter to grow up with of your head being blown off?
Well, the thing is if you did that much heroin, even an experienced junkie would put him into heroin sleep like that. How come when the police came and at the crime scene, his heroin rig was all put away nice and clean. The needle was back in there and everything.
Very far away from his body, too.
And then another aspect is he was left-handed. The rifle from the evidence there was fired from a right-handed position. Who does that? I mean, if you're going to kill yourself, you're going to just do what you normally do, and that's use the proper hand you are, like for me. Right. For one, I will never commit suicide. If you find me dead, I was killed. I just have to make that claim. But
same here.
Exactly. Exactly. We're not going to kill ourselves. But if I kill myself,
far too much to just throw in the towel.
Right. I would grab the gun from the right handed position. And I also, and correct me if I'm wrong, the length of the gun would make difficult. To pull the trigger.
Yeah,
because it was a hunting shotgun, not a home protection, which has a reduced barrel in my mind. So there's a lot of interesting things. The door was locked.
You know? Yeah, but here's the thing. It was one of the twist and pull like locks where you could lock it from the inside as you're leaving and closing the door.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the cops tried to say, oh, no, he could only been in there by himself because it was because of the lock. But no, mm-hmm. it was the type of lock where you could lock it from the inside and yeah. walk out and just close the door behind you.
Yeah.
That, and then the shotgun shell was on the wrong side of the body.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There were no legible fingerprints on the gun or the pen that was through the pot. They're in a greenhouse, right? So the right, alleged suicide right. note had a pen sticking through it to mm-hmm. kind of keep it down.
Yeah,
gotcha. Within like the potting soil or whatever. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing about that. If you watch the movie Soaked in Bleach, which is it's fully based on Tom Grant's account of what he found during his time working for Courtney Love, you find out that Tom was actually contacted by Rosemary Carroll. Mm-hmm. Rosemary Carroll was Kurt's entertainment lawyer and Courtney's entertainment lawyer. Mm-hmm. She was married to Danny Goldberg of Gold Mountain, who was the management company behind Nirvana. She was concerned that she felt that Kurt didn't write the suicide note. She brought Tom to her office. She gave some items that were in Courtney's backpack that she left behind. And it was handwriting samples.
Mm-hmm. I know where you're going on this. Keep going, brother. This is some good information, man.
Handwriting samples in the backpack. Mm-hmm. And they actually show you in the movie the suicide note and the letters that were being copied over and over again of the alphabet.
Yeah.
And they line up to what the lines in the so-called suicide note that would point to suicide.
And plus from
they line them up and they show it on camera mm-hmm. on the screen.
Yeah.
And in addition to it,
wasn't the language, when you look at it from a logistics or a linguistic standpoint, that the language of the overall letter didn't match the last part, where he pretty much said the "I'm sorry" part, if you will. There was a discrepancy in the language.
It was the last three lines, and I believe it was the first line addressed to Bada, Kurt's childhood imaginary friend.
Mm-hmm. So what it appears to be is something that Kurt wrote that somebody.
Like a retirement letter to his fans in the music industry because he was burned out and he didn't want to continue with the Geffen machine. And I do believe that Geffen, and this is my opinion, not Nature Boy's, but I do believe Geffen has a bigger play in the Kurt's story.
Well, he's worth more dead.
As I will point out later on with my good friend Peter Sikosh when we talk about the John Lennon assassination. Because David Geffen was right in the heart of that as well with Yoko Ono and John Lennon.
Well, if you think about it from this standpoint, from their financial position, some artists are worth more dead than alive for them from their financial position.
Yeah.
And I mean, so was David Geffen part of it? I don't know. It's first I've heard of it. But I'll tell you this, if the facts came out that said, yes, he was involved, and they're bona fide facts, I wouldn't be surprised one bit. I would probably much go, that's just kind of how Hollywood really works behind the scenes, and not what's shown to us, the plebs, but what really happens, you know, especially we heard all those stories about those parties that have these special parties in the special rooms that only certain people get invited to type of things.
Well, when it comes to that, I'll just say this. If anybody out there thinks I'm full of shit, that's fine. But just Google the Scorpions, the band, the Scorpions.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which member it was, but he admitted to going to snuff film parties in Hollywood in the 1980s.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Just Google
Dude, Chris, you don't.
I don't mean to bring the party down, but I have a feeling with Dave McGowan, which we originally, and I'm bringing it full circle a little bit.
Yes, you are.
Dave McGowan in his work the pedophocracy, he called it, in his book, Programmed to Kill.
Yeah.
He talked about these insider Hollywood dealings when it came to snuff films. He expanded on it in behind in the Laurel Canyon book.
Strange Scenes Inside
the Canyon. I'm the biggest Dave McGowan fan, and I've worked all day, so
your ass is dragging like mine, so totally excusable. Right. That's why I think we bounce really good off each other. So
right, it was strange. I am screwing it up, and I'm not doing him justice, but not strange things, but like
strange scenes from. Let me tell you, for the listeners out there. So I'm going to look this up right now and just keep talking for a second here.
Well, here's the thing. I've been in contact with Dave, the late great Dave McGowan. I've been in contact with his brother Craig for the last 3 years, right? Craig, I've been trying to have on my show he ended up getting sick. He's taking care of his parents and everything. But he had something to say to Donald Jeffries on Donald Jeffries' show, I Protest, in
2024.
We're in 2024. So Donald Jeffries did a tribute show to Dave McGowan in 2021, I believe, or 2020. And he had Craig on to talk about Dave's work and the last year of Dave McGowan's life. The signal during that show, the signal on Craig's end started to get blurry and screwed up. But he started to go into details about strange women that were showing up around Dave's property and everything at the time that he got sick on a show talking about the Boston bombing with a certain guy named John B. Wells of the show
Caravan to Midnight. As a quick side note, right, being a voice person myself, he has one of the quintessential voices in the industry, man. I mean, I wish my voice was
even in JFK, like I was telling you before the recording. Yeah. He's the guy who says in Oliver Stone's JFK, it's going to be in Dallas.
I just pulled it up here. So the proper title for the book, and anybody out there that's listening who's not familiar with Dave McGowan, McGowan was a researcher extraordinaire. And if he said this is what happened, he always brought the receipts, because what he pulled out for the average person is unbelievable stuff.
But let's put it this way, David, or Nature Boy, sorry.
Either name, I'm cool with it, man. Just don't call me late for dinner. I'm good, man.
He was the world's, in my opinion, he was the world's first 9/11 truther on 9/12. He had the whole event dissected on 9/12/2001.
But Chris, let me read this off. Let's get back. Let's get back to the Kurt Cobain, because I think I'm fascinated with that. Right. But his book, everybody out there listening, is phenomenal. I read it and it is an eye opener about what happened during the late 60s and 70s in the formation of modern pop music.
It was California weird sound. Scenes inside the canyon, right?
Weird scenes inside the canyon. Laurel Canyon, covert ops, and the dark heart of the hippie dream. Great book. That's right. So anybody out there,
Shame on me for not remembering it. Shame on me, because I've been researching and I've been a fan of this guy for a long time. Shame on me.
Oh, no shame. As my friend said, oh, homeboy, ain't no shame to this game, bro. Ain't no shame to this game. So go on. Let's get back to Kurt. So do you remember the stopping point that we were?
Yeah, I went on so many different tangents. Kurt, actually, his story ties.
Oh, we were talking about heroin, his heroin abuse, how he was allegedly getting off of the heroin and the doses.
He had a proper medication that he was properly diagnosed with a pinched nerve in his stomach in November of 1993.
Right.
So his excuse for having heroin, and of course, a lot of people that don't understand drug addiction or don't understand that kind of thing. They're going to say, of course he's going to say he was off heroin, blah, blah, blah. But he was really happy about it. And he was boasting about it in front of the rock journalists at the time, including MTV and various fanzines. He was happy at the fact that he didn't have this pinched nerve and this anguish, this pain he was in anymore. Now, he didn't have to rely on opiates to just be able to survive or just live day by day.
Right, yeah.
And I feel like a common thing that is used to control people in, you know, that have any kind of sway when it comes to public opinion or shaping the public opinion throughout history in terms of like Hollywood or music, whatever, pills and heroin and substances have been used since the beginning of time when it comes to entertainment.
Let me interject here for a second. As in the book by John Potash.
I've had him on my show too, and his was a logical extension from Abe's work, and that was weapons, drugs used as
weapons against us. And it was a fantastic companion piece to Dave's work.
So, because Dave had mentioned that he wanted to talk about the grunge era and the rap era after the things he covered in Weird Scenes, which was the mid to late 60s, the anti-war movement, you know, right. All those things. He was convinced, because if you go back, and you look at his website, he had a great sense of humor. He called it the Center for an Informed America, CIA. And that was his website, who his daughter, Lissa, still keeps up to this day. You see, in some of his newsletters, he talks about how he would like to get back to that subject after his moon landing, which was
moon dogs, awesome. I believe it was
wagging the moon dog, which opened up my eyes when it came to, did we really land on the moon? Because he does it with such grace and such comedy.
Chris, I think I need I'm to bring you, I think I need to bring you on, and I think we do need to probably do a full show on just Dave McGowan, because we could fill out about 2 hours. And my dream just popped in my brain, so I'm going to say it. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but I want to share it before I forget it. I'd love to get Tom Grant and you on. So I'm going to start working on getting Tom, and I think he's doing interviews right now, so I might be able to land him. And then just put you two in the same Zoom room.
I tried to get him on my show, and I had worked with him in 2008.
I'll get him.
He seemed, good luck. I hope you do, believe me, but he seemed to be comfortable in his retirement at the time. But this was like 2 years ago, so maybe you had better.
It's the 30th anniversary of Kurt's death or something like that, some anniversary. But I'll tell you what.
I hope you do. That would be great.
If I get him on and I book him, then I'm going to bring you two on, and I'm just going to kind of wind you two up, and I'm just going to sit back and watch the magic happen, because that will be a magical show. But let's get back to Kurt Cobain. Now, we've gone through kind of a background on his death, the people that were involved. So both Hank Harrison and Tom Grant basically concluded that Courtney Love.
But having said that, I have to say, not having talked to the guy or met the man, I don't put much stock in Hank Harrison's story at all.
Well, Hank Harrison's story, when I read it, was more of an apology about Courtney Love.
Yeah, well, the background on Courtney, I'll give him companion. He's the father, but
I would say it's a good companion piece to Tom Grant's work, because it really gives you an in-depth look at who Courtney was, that, you know, for the sake of brevity.
He brought up the fact that he had a lifelong friend in the CIA that was in Ireland.
Well, if you follow, hold on, I got to interject here, because we're bringing up so many subjects. I don't want to bounce around, but we have to bounce around a bit. When you look at the history of the CIA, of the Grateful Dead, from the Kesey days into the Grateful Dead, the CIA was heavily involved. I believe it was drugs as used as a weapon against us, where the subject of John Owsley, the bear, the sound guy and the master of making LSD, was an actual CIA asset implanted into the band. So to say that the CIA was injected into that culture and that band is not a far stretch, because it's already been proven in other instances. So to have, and Hank Harrison, I'm not saying he's a CIA asset, but I could see in my mind, with the way the CIA can manipulate people, that yeah, he was just a player in the band, whether he knew it or not. So yeah, and
well, he had a friend. He had a friend that was on his deathbed in Ireland.
Okay.
Who admitted to him that he ended up taking Courtney under his wing and giving her like thousands of tabs of LSD from the CIA, in which he claimed. And then I think she even claimed too. There's even an FBI report on it now. I hadn't been following for a couple of years, but.
And wasn't her goal pretty much
to spread it around the English communities and in Ireland, the music scene.
The music scene, to dose the musicians.
And that was Yoko Ono's objective prior to Courtney Love.
Oh, so Yoko was kind of the original
OG. Yoko Ono ended up getting pregnant. Conveniently, remember May Pang?
Yeah, I do. The Lost Weekend. The whole thing about the Lost Weekend.
You know what I'm talking about? Yes, the Lost Weekend, where he claimed he saw a flying saucer in New York City out the apartment, the window and everything. Mm-hmm. He was with May Pang. He wasn't with Yoko Ono. And he had some good times with May Pang, who I've also tried to have on my podcast too. And yeah, I think she's one of those deals where you know, if she can do promotion or some kind of monetary thing, which I'm totally, you know, street level punk rock when it comes to podcasts. So I wasn't able to really offer her anything for her to come on. But from what she had talked about before, her and John were were very close. And then at one point, Yoko Ono came back around and took John back to the Dakota, I'm assuming. And very shortly after, ended up becoming pregnant with Sean. And then him and May Pang were no more. That was nothing anymore. But the reason I brought that up is because I always looked at the Courtney Love thing and the Yoko Ono thing. Because I think even Dave Grohl even referred to Courtney as Yoko at the time.
Oh, by the way, I just did a quick search on May Pang. She's still alive. She's 73 years old.
Who, May Pang?
Yeah, and I made a note to have May
Pang. Oh, yeah, I'm friends with her on Facebook.
You are?
I haven't been able to get her on the show just because I don't really have anything to offer her. Pete Best, too, but that's a different story. But so anyway, the reason I brought that up is because shortly after Kurt and Courtney started dating, that is when she got pregnant.
Yeah.
Kurt came from a family of divorce, and he apparently never wanted that to happen to another child, you know, in terms of, so he ended up shortly thereafter marrying Courtney. So she basically got her hooks into him pretty early on in the relationship.
In other words, she Billie Jean'd his ass. Is what
right.
Okay.
And it always reminded me of the John and Yoko thing, because he had a good thing going after with May Pang and everything. And then all of a sudden, you know, Yoko came back around. And you remember, Yoko also claimed she didn't know who the hell the Beatles were when she met John, which at the time, it's like, come on. The Beatles were the biggest thing on the planet.
And when you look at her background,
she's doing avant-garde.
She comes from a very affluent family, by the way, from what I understand. She wasn't just your average commoner like you and I. She had a little
avant-garde. Three things with a nail and a block of wood, you know, all these things make you think, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a nail and a fucking
let's
block
go
of
back
wood.
To okay, that. Yeah, right. I got to pop that in. My God, Chris, you were just lighting off so many firecrackers in my brain right
I'm
now.
Sorry,
right?
It's all over.
No, we're going back to the CIA because it always comes back to those bastards for some reason. But one of the things that the CIA funded, probably, I'm not sure if it started in the 50s or in the 60s, but I know it was probably in the 60s, the formation or the funding of this new art, your Andy Warhols, this stuff where you look at it, and it's like, dude,
you know, the best example,
it's a turd in a jar.
Who's the guy who threw this shit at the screen? And they're like, oh yeah, that's
that's art. That's art. And they pay outrageous money and people just fawn over them. And that was part of a CIA legit look at documents in history, legit operations.
Sent that to Dawn for Hidden History 3. What do you call that? Jackson Pollock, where you literally throw shit out of it.
Oh, that was Jackson Pollock that did that, huh?
It was the CIA, but that was basically what they were saying. Oh, this is art now.
And Kerouac.
Kind of less than an art. And I'll tell you one other thing. I don't even know if you know about this, but do you know that when they made adaptions or adaptations of 1984 and Animal Factory or Animal Farm. The George Orwell estate, right? Mm-hmm. You know who's in charge of procuring the rights to be able to transfer that into motion pictures and animation?
No, but I'm sure it's going to blow my mind. Who was it?
Howard Hunt.
Are you kidding me?
Who a lot of people think was one of the tramps.
Are you kidding me? Howard Hunt.
JFK assassination.
Oh, geez.
That's on record if you Google that. I sent that to Donald, too.
So he was in charge. He was the guy that made it happen between the Orwell estate.
Who went to George Orwell's widow.
Right, and said, hey, baby, I can make you some money. His work needs to be done. I'll fund it. Don't worry about it. That was E. Howard Hunt who got the funding and the permissions and all that stuff to make those adaptations.
The legal rights to be able to adapt it in either animation or film.
There's no denying a CIA connection in what you just told me. That's why I knew it would blow my mind, dude. There is no denying that when anything that E. Howard Hunt was involved with was pure covert CIA operations. The stuff
Have you ever heard the story of E. Howard Hunt's ex-wife and her demise?
I heard about some vague things that
Airplane crash.
Oh, yeah. Don't, if you're ever going to blow the whistle, don't go in small aircraft. In fact, depending on how big the
Right.
But if you're a leader of a country and you know, like the Jackal or like a John Perkins comes to you and says, I got a deal you can't refuse. If you refuse the deal, don't even get in a plane.
In a plane, there's a lot of different ways they take these people out, but E. Howard Hunt's widow died in a plane crash where in the neighborhood where that plane ended up crashing, the neighbors in the neighborhood actually claimed that there were FBI and police and fire waiting for the plane to crash.
Kind of like Oklahoma City and the ATF and the bomb trucks waiting about an hour before, kind of around the
corner. ATF was warned to not go into work that morning, and there was the bomb squad truck.
The bomb squad truck
around the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know something else? I also talked to.
We can go down.
I didn't talk to. I tried to get Donald connected for Hidden History 3, but the original daycare center operator, she won't talk to anybody to this day.
Can you blame him?
Oh, I don't blame her at all.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, her husband was actually in charge of the security for the Murrah building, and he was fired shortly before. Telling you, Oklahoma City, they had helicopters above that building when the explosion happened, and it was actually caught on film by people in Oklahoma. And I had a guy, I'm trying to remember his name, but he goes... He makes movies under a company called Free Mind Films.
Yes, I'm very familiar with. I can't.
His name is Chris.
He just did the Jones Plantation.
I'm remembering his name, but he talked to certain people that would back up what I'm saying, that there were actually, you know, helicopters above the Murrah building. And I think I sent you and a whole bunch of other people who don't want anything to do with me now. Because I sent them so much crap, like so many links because of my OCD or whatever. But there was weird helicopter activity above the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Yeah, I've heard about that. I've also heard stories, and I'll call them that, about the Doomsday plane flying around 9/11.
The EB-4s, the Doomsday planes, were Doomsday. Above Washington and New York. They were white. They were caught on camera. That's not even what I'm talking about, but you're right.
This is kind of ironic, because one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I know we started
was
with
the Boston
JFK,
bombing, and I went every other direction.
In fact, the initial title I had for the show was going to end with false flag question mark. Boston bombing, false flag, question mark. And we just came full circle. You had no idea what I was thinking to false flags. But that rabbit hole, my friend, could take us down to conversations for hours. And I think we've been on here for probably an hour and 30 minutes. But let's go. Let's wrap it up.
Before we end, can we mention a couple of things about the Boston bombing?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. Being here in New England at the time, I was actually at Logan Airport. I think I told you before we even started recording. I was flying in from California into Logan Airport. We ended up seeing like the National Guard troops with the AK-47s patrolling. Right. And I think the last time that they were actually patrolling Logan Airport in Boston was on 9/11/2001. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. A couple of days later, I was watching live on CNN.
We're down to 3 minutes, so I wanted to just give that cue.
I was talking to Monica Perez, right?
Lovely. I love Monica.
We were talking about the same thing. I was watching CNN when they arrested the older brother, and he was naked.
Oh, yeah.
Put him in the back of the police cruiser, but then the next day, early in the morning, the next day, the story changed. That his younger brother escaped and ran him over with an SUV. Sure. But if you were in Boston and you heard the talk radio and the callers that were calling in, they confirmed that it was a police cruiser that ran over the older brother.
Yeah,
your brother.
That's a story, and that's why I want to bring you back on. That's the whole thing I want to talk about, because that's a rabbit hole and false flags.
I saw him. He was arrested, dude, and the reason he was naked is because they wanted to make sure he didn't have any explosives on his person.
Yeah.
But he was in the back of the cruiser. They killed him. They ran him over with a police cruiser, dude.
Well, Chris, we're getting down to we have about a minute left, about a minute and a half left. So let's wrap it up. Where can people find you if they want to hear this amazing, amazing information?
Well, I really haven't, to be honest, I've been trying to DoorDash because I've been trying to actually have the beginnings of having some kind of a life.
Oh, yeah. Got to pay the bills, brother. Got to pay the bills. Are you on Twitter? Are you?
Well, here's the thing. I'll just say this. Right. Watch my good friend Naughty by Nature, his show.
Oh, you do.
My good friend Franco, aka Angry Tiger, on Free World.
All right.
He has a show called Tiger Tales, and
all right.
I'm on Rumble. It's digging Chris Graves, but I haven't really had any shows lately.
Go check out his channel. Watch anything that you can find. Google Chris Graves. Absorb anything you can, because this guy's incredible, and we're going to bring him back on. Because we have to talk, but honestly, I'm running up against the clock and I have 45 minutes left. So, Chris, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to bring you back on. I got some really good ideas. But before I do that, housekeeping, I can be found. One of the things I really want to promote right now is my audio podcast. It's Naughty by Nature with Nature Boy. Naughty is spelled N-A-U-T-I as in nautical. Hate listeners, I love y'all, but spell my name right. I can be found on Rumble. Every Friday night at 11 p.m. Eastern, we have an encore presentation on the TNP, the New Prisoners Rumble channel. I can be found anywhere audio podcasts are found, and I am joining freeworldfm.com. So everybody, we've got 4 seconds left. Thank you for joining us. Please come back. Please share the show, and please support everything this great man does. And at that, I'll say good night.